Civilization, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
In this episode, you'll hear from an English constitutional law expert and researcher, Albert Burgess. This was a talk given during the Democracy in Danger event in Shoreham, West Sussex, during April 2015. And this was a particularly lively presentation due to the amount of heckling that went on. And it did get a little out of hand at times because of the amount of rival views in the room. But it eased off, and ultimately most of the people in the room ended up being pretty happy with what they'd heard, and they were quite amicable in the end with Albert Burgess and most of his views, maybe not all of them. So just bear that in mind when you listen to this. There was a Q&A session at the end, but I decided not to include that as part of this episode because it did go into quite a lot of detail regarding various police actual cases, which I feel perhaps we shouldn't go out on there because there may be a few details there that may be a little sensitive. I'm possibly overreacting, but you'll hear the main speech, which was the best part anyway. So at the end, Albert actually offered a book out to everyone, regard just a small little pamphlet really about English constitutional law, and I've had a bit of a read of it, and it's very good. And I've studied law at an academic level. I did a law degree, so I kind of have a bit of a grounding in law, and I think most of what Albert has said in the book and during this speech was really good, and certainly I can't really fault it at all. I think he's done his homework. So just by way of introduction, I just want to perhaps just read the what it says on the back of his book. So Albert Burgess served as a police constable for 12 years, special constable, which the special constable in the UK, for those that don't know, that's somebody who, they're essentially a police officer, no different to a regular police officer, but they do it on a voluntary basis, so it's an unpaid profession. But it's as much a police officer as any other police officer. So he served as a special constable for 12 years, including 10 years in two very busy London divisions, where he personally made over 200 arrests, many for crimes and drink driving offences. He was also involved in three murder inquiries, and one of which he detained the prime suspect. During this time, Albert also made it his labour of love to study and memorise the laws of the land, so as to better carry out his daily tasks. And later he became concerned at the lawlessness of governments, prompting him to delve into the intricacies of English constitution. This book is the result of those endeavours. And you can buy a copy of this book by going to EnglishConstitutionGroup.org, where I think you can get hold of a copy. And you also can contact Albert directly. So I'm going to just let you give it a listen. He's quite a royalist, and he doesn't have any issues or qualms with that. He's not one to mince his words, and you'll hear in the episodes, there were times where the audience turned on him, and it got very heated at times, but it eased off in the end, and like I said earlier, ultimately he won the room over. So here we go, Albert Burgess.
Welcome to the final talk in the series of Democracy in Danger. Now, we're very pleased this evening to have somebody who has spent most of his life pursuing the law. He was a policeman, an ex-policeman. And in doing that course from his work, he's also compiled, I would think, one of the most extensive dossiers on a very important subject which affects us all, that I think anybody could have done, and that is the British Constitution. Now, if you're unsure about even if we have a constitution, and some people are, and also how this is how the European Union affects us, which I was talking a little bit about last week, then he's the man to answer a lot of your questions and to inform you. So, Without further ado, I will introduce tonight's guest speaker, Alton Burgess.
Good evening. Firstly, there is no British Constitution. There is an English Constitution, and by the grace of Edward III, a Scottish Constitution, because when he trashed the Scots and captured the Scottish King David, he allowed him to go back and rule Scotland as a vassal king to England, and he allowed him to keep Scottish law and Scottish constitution. So when people like government, and government do this all the time, talk about the British constitution or the UK constitution, that simply reflects the depth of their ignorance of the country they live in and purport to govern. And they're generally ignorant, otherwise they wouldn't have made such a pig ear of governors over the last 40 years, would they? Now, knowledge is a weapon. And as the man said, I was a policeman, so I'm used to law, I'm used to reading about law. And I was given some documents which were rescued from the Public Records Office by a man called David Barnby on our membership of the European Union. And this was the government's actions under the Heath government as to how to get us in there. Now, Heath asked the Lord Chancellor, how will it affect us if we join the European Union? And the Lord Chancellor, who was obviously the top judge in the country, said, it will be a problem because the English Constitution doesn't allow it. But we can get around the Constitution if you want to. And of course Heath wanted to, and so the judge obligingly got around the Constitution. But you can't get around the Constitution. The English Constitution, it started a long, long time ago, and it started with Alfred the Great. When he first became the King of the English, and he controlled all of the old kingdoms up to Watling Street, which is roughly across the country, cutting it from coast to coast, through Oxford to Wales, right? And basically that part of England was his. And he, in fact, having sorted out all the Danish and got relative peace and everything else, set about educating the people. He was a great one for education, and he thought people shouldn't be stupid. So if he had an earldoman who couldn't read and write, he told him he had to learn to read and write. And if the earldoman said, get lost, then he removed his earldom from him and he appointed somebody else who was younger and who was prepared to learn to read and write. Because he wanted people who were educated running the various parts of the kingdom and the various jobs that had to be done. Having sorted that little thing out, he then sat down and he looked at all of the laws from the old kingdoms. And he selected the best laws and customs from all of the old kingdoms that comprised his kingdom. And he wrote them down in a book called The Dun. And he then showed this to the Witan, which was his parliament, and he said, is this good law? And they said, yes, it's very good law. And so he then promulgated that throughout his kingdom as the King's Law. And that was the first ever book of English constitutional law, and it covered everything. And one of the things that Alfred the Great said is, I won't fine you unless you've been found guilty of an offence in a court of law. And I won't make you suffer any forfeiture. So if you've got a nice horse and I fancy your horse, I'm not going to come home and say, well, I rather like that horse. I'm not going to, I would have to buy it off of you, but I won't simply take it and say, well, I'm taking your horse. Unless there's a reason that I can convict you in a court of law and take the horse as payment of a debt or something. Right? So Alfred the Great had good law. And he instilled this law in the judges, because up until fairly recently, I'd say the last 40 years, English judges were acknowledged as the best in the world. The reason for that was simple. Alfred the Great hung 40 of them. And he hung them for things like, there were one particular judge, had a guy on trial. The guy was found not guilty by the jury on a 9-3 vote. 9 said he was guilty, 3 said he wasn't. So under our system, he's not guilty, so he goes. So the judge decided that wasn't really what he wanted, so he sacked those three jurors and then vetted another three until he got three that would agree to convict, and then he hung the guy, and then Alfred the Great hung the judge. Another judge didn't even wait for the jury to give their verdict. He simply stopped the trial in the middle, and he hung the guy, and then Alfred the Great hung him as well. And he did this to 40 judges. So the message went out to our judges, do the job right. Because if you don't, you die. And that's why our judges, for hundreds of years, were the best and the fairest in the world. In Europe, they have the thing that what the prince says is the law. So a European king is autocratic. He decides he wants something, he will just help himself to it. You've got a good-looking young wife? Fine, bang, I'll have her. You want to argue about it? You're dead. That's what Europe were doing. Over here, we didn't do that, because the king was subject to the law. And one of our judges, Chief Justice Henry de Bracton, who still taught in universities today, although he was Chief Justice to Henry II, he said, the king is beneath no man, but he is beneath God, and he rules God as, and rules England as God's lieutenant, and according to God's laws. Wouldn't that be nice? And so we have the king is beneath the law, because it is by the law that he becomes king. So our kings are not above the law. They can be arrested. They can be put on trial. But obviously, because he's a king, you don't actually really want to do that, because that causes you untold problems. So what we've done in a typical English way is we say, well, we won't hang the king. What we'll do is we'll place his wicked and evil advisers on trial, and we will actually hang them. And that sends a clear message to the king. Now, after Alfred the Great died, and his grandson, Ethelred, actually unified the whole kingdom, Alfred's law became the law of the whole kingdom. And when Edward the Confessor died, he hadn't made any law, because he was so religious, he spent all his time praying. He never made a single law. The whole time he was king, not a single law was passed. So we've still operated on Alfred's laws. Obviously, Duke William of Normandy didn't accept the validity of Harold, who said he said Harold was a usurper, and he'd been promised the thing, the crown by Edward the Confessor. In fact, one of the things that kings in England can't do is they can't promise the crown to somebody else. They can't say, well, when I die, John, you can be king. That's not allowed. They can write it down, but it won't happen. Our kings are elected. Alfred the Great was elected by the people of England for doing a good job and defending the country. Our kings are elected. Up until King James II, when we had a coronation, a knight in full armour would ride into Westminster Abbey, and he would throw a gauntlet on the floor, and he would say, are there any foul and base traitors in here who deny this man's right to be king? If there are, step outside and we'll sort it out now. If somebody said, I don't think he should be king, they go outside, they put the old armour on, and then they would have a battle. If the king's champion lost, then the man didn't become king. The other guy did. But if the king's champion won, well, that shut everybody up. Yeah? So basically, there are all sorts of things about kingship which people don't understand. I see an awful lot on the internet of people saying, oh, the Queen's got all this money. The Queen's got all these palaces. Why can't she get a council flat, you know, a two-bedroom council flat? And why can't she live in that? And then we can make Buckingham Palace and Windsor Castle social housing. Well, she's not allowed to, by law. Because when Alfred the Great became king, he came along and he said, well, I'm going to make this bloke an earl. And he gave him part of the money and part of the ground that he'd been given. Because when he was first appointed king, they said, well, you've got to have If you're going to be a king, you've got to have more than the ordinary man. You've got to stand out above the ordinary man. So the people themselves agreed the king should have this. So they gave him the best house. They gave him the best grounds. They gave him pots of money. And they said to him, that's to make sure that everybody knows you're the king. And it did, didn't it? Everybody knew he was the king. He lived in the big house on the top of the hill with, you know, all the bloody horses running around on his beautiful estates and, you know, all the rest of it. But when Alfred the Great came and said, I'm going to make this man an earl, they actually took some of his land and he gave it to him. And he said, well, here's some money as well, now you're an earl, that's fine. And then the people thought about that. And they had a meeting. And they said, if the king goes on does this, and every time he creates a baron, every time he creates a baron, we're actually going to give him part of the king's grounds and part of the king's money. It won't be very long before the king has got nothing. So we're going to have a system. If the king wants to make a baron, he tells us. And that would be, in fact, the Witan or Parliament. He tells us. And if we agree that the king's choice of a baron is a good one, then we will allocate some public land to that person, and we will allocate some public money to that person. And that way the king is not diminished, because you cannot diminish the king, because the king has to be at the pinnacle. He has to be at the top, and he has to be obviously at the top. And the people of England, our forefathers, decided this. This is what should happen. Now, that's a good system. But when we had a bad king, like for example, William Rufus was a bad king who thought he ruled by divine right, because we see an awful lot of rubbish on the internet about, oh, the king's your queen, you rules by divine right, she doesn't. None of our kings have ever ruled by divine right. The Stuarts believe they did, but they were Scottish anyway. None of our kings have ever ruled by divine right. They rule because the people elected them. And when we had people like William Rufus who got out of order and started doing things that were wrong, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, William Rufus was shot through the heart with an arrow by a man who was aiming at a hart, which was a deer, and the arrow missed the heart, glanced off a tree, and hit William Rufus. This was in the days when an English archer could take the eye out of a pigeon at 100 yards in flight. But it was an accident, so the man wasn't prosecuted for it. When we had another king, like Edward II, who was pretty useless, but he was also homosexual, and he was appointing all these homosexual friends into nice posh positions. Well, they decided he had to go, so they forced him to resign the crown, and then they took him to Berkeley Castle and they jammed a red poker up his back passage. I had a friend who was psychic who went to Berkeley Castle. And she said, if you were psychic and you go to Berkeley Castle, you can still hear him screaming. The agony of it. So we do this. When King Charles I got out of order and decided he ruled by divine right and he wasn't going to do what he was expected of him, then they gave him the Grand Remonstrance. They did the Petition of Right in 1628, and they gave him the Grand Remonstrance in 1640, and then in 1649 they cut his head off because he wasn't doing it right. So our kings do not rule by divine right. Now, our problem is not Queen Elizabeth. Our problem is not the hereditary peerage. Our problem is the common man in the House of Commons. Because when in 1297, King Edward I invited the common man in because he thought he would be able to get his taxes paid far easier if the common man actually had a say about it. The common man invited in, which was the knights and the burgesses from the various shires around the country. And they all were invited in and they thought, oh, this is fun. Yeah, we'll give the king his money. And then they went away and had a little chat and they thought, well, if he wants money, we can get stuff back. And ever since then, they've been on a power grab. In 1420, the king wanted money, and so they said they would give him the money, but only if he allowed them to initiate all legislation that went through Parliament. So every bad law that you object to, and I'm sure that you all object to a lot of bad laws that are currently in force, was actually put there by the common man in the House of Commons who is supposed to be looking after your interests, isn't he? And if you look at the history, when the common man has put a bad law through Parliament, it's the House of Lords that have actually chucked it out. It was the hereditary peerage. Now, what happened in 1420 was they got that right. Then the House of Commons in 1609 wrote to the House of Lords and said, we are the burgesses, barons, knights of the High Court of Parliament. And the House of Lords wrote back and said, there is no way we will ever accept you as barons of Parliament, and you are no court without us. And that is true, because all the law lords sit in the House of Lords. Well, they did. Then in 1667, they said to the House of Lords, you can't amend the money bill. If we put through a money bill, you can't amend it. There was a 10-year argument between the House of Lords and the House of Commons over this. And then eventually the House of Lords, for whatever reason, honestly I don't understand why they did it, because they didn't have to, they gave way and said, we will not amend money bills. And that caused us a major problem. Because the House of Lords, set up by our forefathers, Parliament was set up by our forefathers as a tripartite agreement. The House of Commons initiate legislation. The House of Lords vet it and either reject it, ask for it to be amended, or accept it. And if they accept it, it goes to the King, and then the King looks at it and decides whether he believes, according to his conscience, it's good law, and whether he's going to actually approve it or not and give it the assent. Now, in 1677, the House of Lords gave way on amending a money bill. So, in 1909, Asquith put through a budget, and in the budget, he wanted to pay every working man a pension, and that's good. But the House of Lords employed an awful lot of working men, because they had these big estates, didn't they? These big houses. And they knew what the working men was earning, because they also had interests in business, factories, and things like that. They knew what the working man was earning. And they looked at the amount of tax that Asquith wanted to pay for the budget, on top of what the working man was already paying. And so they said, the working man can't afford that. He won't be able to eat. And believing they couldn't amend it and take half the tax and pay half the pension, which is more than the working man was getting anyway, they rejected the budget. Then Asquith went back and said, I'm going to put a bill through Parliament to say that you can't reject a bill. Now, if they can't amend a bill and they can't reject a bill, what's the point of them? So the House of Lords said, well, we won't pass it. He said, in that case, I'm going to put 500 new peers into the House of Lords, and they will vote for its abolition. Now, personally, I think he was talking out the back of his head there, because if you look at people like Prescott, all his life, get rid of the House of Lords, he's horrible. And as soon as he gets the chance to get in there, he's up it like a bloody ferret down a rabbit hole, isn't he? Yeah? Can't get in there fast enough. And I think these 500 peers, once they got the Irving, would have said the same. But the House of Lords caved in, and so they agreed they wouldn't amend money bills, and they wouldn't reject a bill. They could only hold it up for 2 years, and that would be it. So Asquith took the bill to the King, King Edward VII, and King Edward VII looked at it, and he said, I'm not signing this. It's unconstitutional, and it takes away a protection from my subjects. You want this, you've got to go to the country. So Asquith and his ministers now ordered to have an election by the king, as he could, have gone round the country telling everybody those bastards in the House of Lords won't let the working man have a pension. And the House of Lords thought it was beneath them to go round the country and say, well, actually, boys and girls, this is what we've, our reasoning, this is it, you know. You can't afford the extra tax to pay. You're having a problem living now. You can't afford the extra tax. We can't amend it, therefore we've rejected it. It's not that we don't want you to have a pension, it's that we know you can't afford the extra tax. But they didn't do that, so Asquith got re-elected. When the King opened Parliament, he came to reading the King's speech, and he came to the bit about the Parliament Act. He actually said in Parliament, the only reason I am doing this is because my ministers have told me that I have to. So the House of Commons has been on a power grab, but not content with being on a power grab and grabbing the authority of the House of Lords and neutering the House of Lords. After Queen Anne died, up until Queen Anne in 1714, after she died, we got King George I, who only spoke German and a bit of Latin. Although he was related directly to the Stuarts. He was the grandson or great-grandson of Charles II. And the legitimate king. But he didn't speak English, so he didn't bother going to Parliament, he didn't bother going to cabinet meetings, but all of our other kings had always gone to Parliament and had always gone to cabinet meetings. Indeed, it's not a Parliament if the king isn't there. And even if the king is really sick and can't physically sit in Parliament, the rules are that he has to be in a manor house or a palace close to where Parliament is meeting so that if necessary, they can carry him there to see what's going on. This is what the law says. The only time you've, any of you have ever seen Queen Elizabeth in Parliament is the state opening of Parliament, isn't it? Not a single parliament, as long as she has been queen, has been legitimate, because she hasn't been in it. When his son died and King George II came to the throne, he did speak English, because he'd been born in it. And he said, I'm going to go to Parliament, and I'm coming to cabinet meetings. And the government said, oh, no, you can't do that, you're not out. And he spent his entire reign complaining bitterly that his ministers were kings in his kingdom. King George III, who everybody thinks of mad King George who lost us America, don't they? Well, firstly, he wasn't mad. For most of his life, he was perfectly sane and sensible and a very good king. And secondly, he didn't lose us America. I've got a book of King George III's letters at home, and the number of letters in that book to government ministers and to various other people saying, lay off the Americans, don't overtax them, leave them alone, they're English, they won't stand it. And government ignored him. The net result was we had a war with his people in America, and we lost against the wishes of the king. But King George had a 22-year running battle with the House of Commons as to where sovereignty lay. Did it lay with him as the lawfully anointed King of England? Or did it lay with the House of Commons as the elected house? Now, if you ask your Member of Parliament today, he'll tell you it lies with the House of Commons because it's the elected house. But a debate started in Parliament in January 1784. And on the 8th of March 1784, they had a vote on the issue. And after a speech by William Pitt, where he said, is it better to be governed by one despot or 350 despots who can't never agree? And it was agreed that it was better to be ruled by one despot. Not that King George was a despot, he wasn't, he was very good. And King George III won the vote. So not only by the common law of kingship is Queen Elizabeth the Queen, totally the Queen, fully sovereign Queen, not only by the 1559 Act of Supremacy, where it was decided by Parliament that Queen Elizabeth I would be the supreme governor of England, but by parliamentary vote on the 8th of March 1784, Queen Elizabeth is the supreme governor of this country today. Except you won't get your member of Parliament to agree to that. So, basically, the Queen needs our help. Because last November, David Cameron came out and he said, the Queen cannot go anywhere or say anything in public unless I have approved it first. That means that Queen Elizabeth has got less right than you have. She has less freedom than you have. Because you can go where the hell you like, and you can stand naked in Parliament Square and scream whatever you want to. But Queen Elizabeth can't. And that's not right, is it? We want the Queen to be able to stand up and say, no, that's not happening. Now, I had a friend, John Gurry, I don't know if any of you have met him, but he was a great patriot. He was a major in one of the very exclusive yeomanry regiments where your daddy had to be a millionaire several times over to pay your mess bill. Really, they do exist, these things. And because he was an exclusive yeomanry regiment, he spent most of his military career working with the royal family. And he was personally friends with the royal family. And I said to him one day, I said, John, who's your best mate in the royal family? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, whose door could you go and kick on at 3 a.m. and say, I need a bed, the wife's sung me out? He said, Prince Charles. No hesitation, Prince Charles. And he said to me,
look who his best friend was.
Yeah.
Jimmy Savills.
Yeah, but no, you see, you can't say that because... The fact of the matter is that these people, like Jimmy Savile, they gravitate to important people. If you can hang on to a prince, if you can hang on to a government minister,
so you're telling us that they wouldn't have that they would not have vetted Savile.
Don't give me that. What I'm saying to you is that Prince Charles would not have been told.
Oh, I can't believe that. I cannot believe that.
Well,
I've heard other stories about the Queen, that she's not as white as white.
There are a lot of stories about the Queen. There are a tremendous amount of stories about the Queen, none of which have I seen any evidence to substantiate. I'm a policeman, I like evidence.
Yeah, but they're very good at covering their tracks.
What?
Yeah.
The Australian Prime Minister, Socialist Minister, Jeff Whitlam, who brought in a load of laws that upset the bankers, and tried to make the country more equitable wealth-wise. He was removed from office.
What happens is, with the Commonwealth countries, the actual Privy Council, is actually the governing body, and it's the Privy Council that make those decisions. But if you look at the Privy Council, there's nobody on the Privy Council that the Queen picks for herself, because every single cabinet minister is on the Privy Council. All of them. And every single cabinet minister, you and I both know, is in the pocket of the bankers. They're all dishonest, they're all crooks, a whole lot of them. So it's not whether the Queen actually does it, it's done in her name, and it's done by the Privy Council. And that's what happens with the Commonwealth countries. But the fact of the matter is that he said to me, John Gurrier said to me, the Queen is absolutely hopping mad about what's going on in the country, but doesn't know how to deal with it.
Can we hear the speaker, please?
Doesn't know how to deal with it. And he said, if you mention the European Union in front of Princess Anne, the air is bluer than it ever was in any barrack room he was ever in his life. So, basically, I think the royals get a rough ride.
They deserve it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think they get a rough ride. I think it's very unfair.
If you take, for example,
Prince Andrew, and they're saying, well, Prince Andrew's a paedophile because he went to bed with a 17-year-old girl, they say. He's denied it, but they say he did. Right? Let's assume this. When she was 17, Prince Andrew was 34. Now, I think you'd be very hard-pushed to find any 34-year-old bloke who wouldn't jump into bed with a 17-year-old dolly bird. It's a fact. But then she said that afterwards she was paid £10,000 for sleeping with Andrew and this dentist fellow in America who's offered to sue her. He said, say that in public and I will sue you. And she hasn't. So what is she? She's not an innocent young girl. She's a 17-year-old young woman and a high-class prostitute.
No, she was a child and it was illegal in America.
It's not illegal here.
Well, it was illegal in America where it happened. Well, what was it? It was here.
What?
It was here. Or part of America.
She met him here.
Yeah.
He
was also very friendly with that convicted paedophile, wasn't he? What was his name? Yeah.
Again, as I said,
these people. Why was he?
Yeah, but these people gravitate to people like that. They do. They gravitate to people who are in authority or positions of power.
But
in
this,
who
in power,
that doesn't excuse
him.
He owned
his own island, didn't he? He was a very wealthy billionaire.
The royals have got access to the very best.
Let's take a major allegation against the Queen and Prince Philip, right? A major allegation by Kevin Annett, this defrocked prince.
I know.
You believe it?
I believe. Well, I know he's a very good friend of his, Kate of Gaia.
Right. Okay. Fine.
And
you believe it?
Now
let me ask you a question, right?
Yeah.
According to Annette, Queen Elizabeth II in 1968, when she was a young queen, went with Philip to an orphanage, picked up 8 kids, took them away, sexually abused them, murdered them and disposed of their bodies. Right? The question I'm going to ask you is, how?
Well, very easy.
She is the most heavily guarded woman in the world. Not only everywhere does she go, she is escorted by armed police officers from Scotland Yard. When she goes to somewhere like Canada, the Canadian government will give them their own close protection squad. Everywhere she goes is surrounded by uniformed mounted policemen and thousands upon thousands of people with cameras waiting to take a picture of her.
Well, not that she's in one of her cameras.
And you'll guarantee that MI6 and the Canadian MI5 will be thick on the
ground.
She runs them. They catch allegiance to her. The politicians catch allegiance to her. She can do exactly what she likes.
How can she do that?
And no matter how you bow before her, you probably won't be allowed in there. You'll be heavily vetted.
Yeah.
They knew Jimmy Savile, they knew exactly what Jimmy Savile was up to.
Yeah.
I doubt that.
And what about all of the knighthoods and that she's given to all the paedophiles?
Yeah. She doesn't give them. The thing is now that knighthoods for a long time and peerages are given at the recommendation of the government.
They have to be vetted.
They give them at the recommendation of the government. All of these people who are in Parliament now, in the House of Lords, most of them shouldn't be there. You've got all of these, Baroness, who stole £126,000 in expenses. How many of you know what a denizen is? A denizen is a naturalised subject. And according to the law of England, a denizen has most, though not all, of the rights of a natural-born subject. They can buy and sell property. They can inherit and leave property. They can run a business. What they cannot do and cannot ever do by law, and it is still current law, which government are ignoring, is they cannot have any order of nobility, They cannot sit in either House of Parliament, nor can they sit on the Privy Council, nor are they allowed to hold any office of public trust. That is the law of England. And in case you doubt it, this is Sir Matthew Hale's book. He was one of our top justices. He's the Chief Justice in 1713. He actually is acknowledged as one of our best ever judges. You've all heard of Blackstone. Blackstone's quoted quite a lot on the internet. Blackstone was a Chief Justice in 1768. In here it talks about denizens. This is a facsimile copy of a book from the House of Commons Library. It is the last book ever written on the royal prerogative. It is the book that Parliament currently use when questions of the royal prerogative come up. And on page 15 of this book, it says that a denizen cannot be awarded any order of nobility. They cannot sit in either House of Parliament, they can't sit on the Privy Council, and they can't hold any office of public trust. And it also says that the Queen is forbidden from changing that law. So how do we have so many denizens in Parliament? Miliband is a denizen. How can we have Miliband in Parliament?
Lord, the Queen is German anyway.
No, she's not.
She is not.
The Queen, you can trace the Queen back. You trace the Queen's family tree back to Ethelred the Unready as Anglo-Saxon.
They've only offered, they've only been speaking English for less than 100 years.
Yeah. Rubbish.
Richard III's descendant is in Canada.
He died.
Why are they royal? No. Explain to
Richard
us why they're royal.
What?
What's different to their blood to our blood?
Well, I would explain that. No, I would explain that. When
you
I
can't
the meeting. No, when I started to explain the meeting, the people decided that whoever they appointed.
So their blood's the same as ours?
Yes, but the people decided whoever became king should have
it. It wasn't the people, it was a couple of noblemen.
No, it wasn't.
It was half a dozen, maybe the most powerful.
Do you know what the Estates of England
are? Maybe 50 or 100.
Do you know what the Estates of England
are? If you can't even. If you put all the people together and you say we're the national people, you know, we're the people of Britain. That's wrong. You're starting off from the wrong position.
I'm not saying people of Britain.
There is a huge division between the rich and the poor, and there's always been.
Do you know what the Estates of England are? Do you know what the Estates of England are?
Presumably pieces of land, parcels of land.
There's nothing to do with land.
Oh, you tell us.
The Estates of England are the Lord's spiritual, the Lord's temporal, and the commonality of England. They are the highest law-giving authority in this country. It was the Estates of England that met and decided that the king should have more than anybody else. It was the Estates of England who met King John at Runnymede, because when the ordinary people found out that King John was beating the barons at Runnymede, they all went home. They hated him. He was abusing them with foreign mercenaries. The barons hated him because he was taking their good-looking wives, forcing them into bed with him, and because they weren't there willingly, the following day, he was going into court and saying, "Oh, I Roger so-and-so's wife last night, she's a terrible lady. Look, of course she was, she didn't want to be there." The Estates of England are the commonality of England. And once it was found out that the King John was beating the barons, the common man in England, thousands upon thousands of them, went home, picked up their swords and their longbows, and they all trooped off to Runnymede. In 1366, the Pope demanded the monies that King John agreed to pay for surrendering England to the Pope, which was 1,000 marks a year. In 1366, the Pope demanded that money. King Edward III knew nothing about it. He asked the bishops and the House of Lords what they thought about it. They went away and they spoke to the commonality of England. They had a meeting of the Estates of England. The King is not one of the Estates of England. He does not attend their meetings. The Estates of England decided that Edward III was not a vassal king to Rome, that the Estates of England decided the money was not to be paid. In 1689, it was the Estates of England that drew up the Declaration of Rights, which deposed James II, and which in fact brought William the First onto the throne in this country. It was the Estates of England. So all of these things you're talking about were all done by your forefathers. They were all done by your forefathers. Now, you might not agree with your great-great-great-great-great-granddad. Doesn't matter. He did it.
So, sorry, the third component of the estates is the commons. What you're saying, the commons...
The commonality. You mean the ordinary common man.
Right.
The ordinary common man.
Okay.
If we need a meeting of the Estates of England now. I'm trying, without a lot of luck, I have to say, because the hereditary peers have been so beaten up for so long by the commons, they've lost the will to fight. I'm trying to get a meeting where all of the barons arrive at Hyde Park, all in their ceremonial robes, and then we can get millions, as many of us as we can with them, and we can go to Buckingham Palace and demand the Queen comes out and talks to us. And we would actually, with the barons, the Lords Spiritual, the Lords Temporal, and us, be the commonality of England. We would be the Estates of England, the largest, most powerful law-giving body in this country.
You're living in an awful illusion. I mean, you're lost in detail and history. There's no relevance in anything you say.
Excuse me, can I make a suggestion?
Yes.
That we actually listen to the speaker and then perhaps at the end we have an extended time of discussion.
Yes, great suggestion.
We are going to do that. We are talking history. We are talking about English history. We are talking about how our forefathers actually developed the best system of government in the world, which has been destroyed over the last 40 years. We're talking about how our forefathers got the most honest, and our kings got the most honest judiciary in the world, which has been destroyed over the last 40 years. And we have to get it back. We have to get this country back. And that doesn't mean that, you know, everybody goes along. I was at a talk on the river. I gave a talk on the river, and I gave it to a load of peers. There were about a dozen peers and a couple of dozen other people there. And there was an old earl there. He was 80. And he came there, and he had a very threadbare coat on, frock coat, down his knees. And from his shoulders to his knees was full of decorations, his decorations that he'd got throughout his life. And he said, when he was 25 and he left university, he went to work for the Foreign Office. And if he had to take some papers up to Liverpool from London, he got paid £5 a week. He had to pay his own fare to Liverpool. And if he had to stay overnight, he had to pay his own accommodation in Liverpool. He got no expenses at all. And then when he inherited the earldom, he went into the House of Lords. And for 40-odd years, he'd sat in the House of Lords, doing the best that he can for the working man. And now he's been thrown out. And all he wants to do is get back into the House of Lords so he can continue to do the best he can for the working man. But who threw him out? Tony Blair threw him out. Again, the common man on a power grab. Let's get rid of the hereditary peerage, because the hereditary peerage are actually part of the backbone of the country. Mm-hmm. Where we see all these people talking about, oh, I'm in lawful rebellion under Article 61 of Magna Carta, they're not in lawful rebellion. Lawful rebellion under Article 61 of Magna Carta says that the peers have to present a petition to the Queen, which the peers took the petition in 2001 to the Queen. They weren't allowed to deliver it to the Queen, although one of the peers was a Duke, another one was a Viscount. Personally, if I'd been a Duke and the policeman said you can't come in, I'd have kicked the little bugger in out of the way. Mm-hmm. So I'm a Duke, get out of my way. I'm going to pop you in the ground like a bloody tin tack. Right? But they didn't. So they handed it to a flunky. We don't even know if the Queen ever saw it. they handed it to a flunky. Everybody says, well, I'm in lawful rebellion because they delivered the petition. But you're not. Because what has to happen is you have to swear an oath of allegiance to the Baron's committee. And how many of them have done that? How many have gone and found one of the barons, on the 25 barons on the Baron's committee, and said, I want to swear an oath of allegiance to the Baron's committee? How many? None of them. So therefore they are all in rebellion, and rebellion is a crime. Because they are not following the letter of the law. Our forefathers thought about just about everything. A medieval farmer produced nearly as much an acre as a farmer in 1940, and he had no mechanical tractors, he had no modern fertilisers, and yet he did it because he understood the natural world he lived in far better than we understand it today. Our forefathers were extremely intelligent, bright people. They brought out the best system of government this world has ever known, and it's been wrecked over 40 years. And all the screaming about the Queen and all the rest of it, it will not change it. We need the Queen because the Queen is... We need the Queen because the Queen is a visible figurehead. 80% of the people in this country will follow the Queen.
No. You're wrong.
I am not. Every opinion poll says that. Every opinion poll says that. Well, every opinion poll says that. Why is it whenever the Queen comes out the streets are packed to overflowing?
Because the people have been dumbed down.
Because they get a day off.
Yeah.
Can we just listen to Albert and then have questions at the end, please? Yes.
Well, look at
the thing. As was requested,
how many people, agree, right?
Well, you don't have to keep saying it. You go if you like. We'd like to hear it first.
Yeah, we'd like to hear
then
Albert
I can criticise. If I don't like it, I'll criticise it, but I want to hear it. All right?
Albert, would you mind clarifying when you keep saying the last 40 years what you specifically referring
to? What we're talking about is Edward Heath. Edward Heath, in fact, when he signed us up to the European Union, what he did was he took the Foreign Office and he asked them what they thought about our joining the European Union. The Foreign Office told him that it would be it gave us serious problems with the Constitution because the Constitution forbids it. There are a number of things in the Constitution which forbid it. Firstly, there's the Act of Supremacy of 1559. That, in fact, contains an oath. Part of that oath says no foreign prince, person, prelate, state, or potentate hath or ought to have any jurisdiction, power, superiority, supremacy, or authority, ecclesiastical or spiritual, in this realm. That oath again is repeated in the 1689 Bill of Rights and Declaration of Rights. So that oath actually forbids any foreign interference in the internal running of this country. We have the meeting of the Estates of England in 1366 with Edward III, where they said that the Pope had no say in England whatsoever, and Edward wasn't responsible to the Pope. Again, for Pope, read anybody, because that's what it means. And yet now we have people coming into the country, they give money to political parties, they get themselves a baronetcy somewhere, and then they go into the House of Lords, and then they steal their expenses, they fiddle the expenses like they're going out of fashion. But they should never be in the House of Lords because they're denizens. And the law is specific. You cannot, as a denizen, sit in the House of Lords. They should not sit in the House of Commons. They're denizens. The law is specific. You cannot sit in the House of Lords. They can't sit on the Privy Council.
Is there a lot of them?
There's hundreds of them. And we have to get them. If we enforce the law on denizens, suppose tomorrow morning we had a miracle and we could enforce the law on denizens. We empty both Houses of Parliament, we empty the Privy Council, and we empty every government and local government building in the country. Because even your local council officers are in jobs of public trust. How many of them are not English working in those buildings? Now, everybody's going to say, would the Race Relations Act change all that? but it can't, because the Queen is not permitted to change it, and because it is constitutional, and the Race Relations Act is statute law, and statute law cannot repliably impeal constitutional law. Now, some law is so great that it can never be done. A custom, who knows what custom is in this country?
Isn't it through case law?
You know what custom is?
It's conduct through case law.
Custom is a law that has been in force for so long with the approval of the people who use it that it can never, ever be changed. All of our rights and freedoms are custom. All of them. Because we've all had the right to go where we want, to say what we want, to do what we want, to marry who we want. And we've had that for 1,000 years. It is custom. The period for a law to become custom is 400 years. Once a law has been there for 400 years, it used to be before time of memory. Chief Justice Coke in 1628 put it at when Richard the Lionheart came to the throne. Anything before Richard the Lionheart was before time of memory and in fact was custom. But that was 400 years after Richard the Lionheart came to the throne. So we say 400 years is the period, that every law that's 400 years old is the custom and practice of this country. We have two laws in this country, we had two laws in this country brought in by Edward III. One was the Act of Provisals of 1351. The Act of Provisals, Edward brought in because when people were dying, or they were getting very old and thought they might die soon, they would leave in their will a couple of farms to the local abbey, because they wanted to buy their place in heaven. And what would happen is that the local abbey would get those farms, and they would promptly sign them over to the Pope in Rome. So the Pope owned an awful lot of real estate in England. And Edward III felt this was an affront to his honour and dignity of king, as King of England, and so he brought in the Law of Provisals, the Act of Provisals of 1351, which made it an offence akin to treason to dispose of any English asset to a foreign owner. He also brought in the Act of Premonury in 1351. That made it an offence akin to treason to import any foreign law into this country, which is why we say that only the King's law is current in this country. It's the only law that we worry about. He also made it an offence to draw, as he put it, any of his subjects out of the kingdom to be tried in a foreign court. Now we have the European arrest warrant. He also made it an offence for any of his bishops to excommunicate any of his subjects on the instructions of the Pope. Now both of these laws were extremely inconvenient to the people who wanted to take us into the European Union. So the Act of Provisals was repealed in the Criminal Law Revision Act of 1948. And the Act of Premonury was repealed by Harold Wilson, who should be on our side because he's a Labour man, isn't he? A working man. Should be. I mean, he wears the raincoat, doesn't he? Smokes a pipe and does all the business. He repealed it, the Act of Premonury, in the Criminal Law Act of 1967. So when in 1972 Edward Heath wanted to take us into Europe, the two laws that would have stopped it had gone. But the question I ask you is this. Is the honour and dignity of Queen Elizabeth II any less than the honour and dignity of King Edward III? Can't be, can it? He was King of England, she's Queen of England. It has to be the same. So if it was treason to dispose of an English asset to a foreign owner, for Edward III because it upset him. It was an affront to his honour and dignity. It's also treason to dispose of an asset to a foreign owner if you're Queen Elizabeth, because it upsets an affront to her honour and dignity as Queen of England. And if you import new law into this country, and on the day we joined the European Union, we imported 2,000 laws, which was more than we'd made for ourselves in the previous 700 years. God knows how many we've imported since. So, one has to ask oneself, is it treason to import these laws? Well, of course it is. It's treason on any number of levels. It's an affront to the honour and dignity of Queen Elizabeth II. It also contravenes the Bill of Rights of 1689, major constitutional law. It also contravenes the Act of Supremacy of 1559, which he makes the Queen the Supreme Governor of England. So it's a personal treason against the Queen on two counts, and on the Constitution on one. Now, I run the English Constitution Group. And I'm a policeman, and I like law. I think the right law, correctly applied, is very useful. So what my group do is we actually draw allegations of treason against various government ministers and we report them to the police. And we say to the police, well, other people around the country doing this, and they report it to their local chief constable. I say, start with your chief constable and work down. Don't start at the bottom and work up. Start at the top and work down. And what we do is we take something like the Maastricht Treaty, which makes the Queen a citizen of Europe. And we point out to the police that this is a constitutional impossibility. And it is imagining Her Majesty's death as a fully sovereign queen in this country contrary to the 1351 Treason Act. So we report John Major, Douglas Hurd and Francis Maud for treason contrary to the 1351 Treason Act of the Maastricht Treaty. So far, we have 5 separate allegations of treason in with the police. So far, 17 police forces around the country have recorded allegations of treason against government ministers. I reported and we've drawn up an allegation against Tony Blair for treason, for subverting the constitutional arrangements of Parliament with his 1999 House of Lords Act, which throughout the hereditary peerage. And because David Cameron and Nicholas Clegg wanted to close the place completely, we've added their names to it. And so far we've got 5 separate police forces that have recorded allegations of treason against Cameron, Clegg and Blair.
Are you aware of Ed Miliband's proposal for some total reshuffle?
Well, we'll get to Ed Miliband in a minute. He's a denizen, he shouldn't even be there. But basically, what we say to our police force, if you live in Cumbria and you report the treason to your chief constable, you say to your chief constable, well, I live in your area, so I'm reporting a crime to you. As it's a reasonable allegation of crime, you have to record it and give it a crime number. If, however, you feel that you are better placed, there is another police force better placed either geographically or economically to undertake such a major inquiry, feel free to transfer the crime to them. So far, 17 police forces, including the Police Service of Northern Ireland, have transferred allegations to the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. I sent my allegations to him straight away, directly. I sent them myself to him. I got a letter back saying, we're not going to do anything with this because your allegations are vexatious. Well, I'm a policeman, I like evidence. So I wrote back and I said, now you've said it, prove it. Where is your evidence that my allegation is not a genuine allegation of a crime and is vexatious? But if you believe it is vexatious, then you believe I'm wasting police time contrary to Section 5.2 of the 1967 Criminal Law Act, which carries a power of arrest. But don't worry about the Mickey Mouse wasting police time charge. Why don't you, because I am naming people that I want to hang, why don't you come and arrest me for the common law offence of perjury, for which I can go to prison for 7 years? And I said to him, I'm prepared to risk 7 years of my life being convicted of perjury. Are you prepared to risk the rest of your life to go to prison for John Major and Tony Blair, just to keep them out of prison, for misprision of treason? Because the minute a jury find me not guilty, and they will find me not guilty, because I have the evidence of the crime, and I'm very good in court, got lots of practice in court, the minute they find me not guilty, I will turn to the bench and I will ask the judge to issue bench warrants for your arrest and your staff's arrest individually for misprision of treason and collectively for compounding treason. They don't reply. And I say to them, I want to reply. What are you doing? Write to me. And they refuse, and they know they can't win. If you report the fact you were burgled, and no policeman come to deal with it, and you complain about it, they'll tell you that Blackburn in 1967 says that the police have a right to pick and choose which crimes they investigate and which ones they don't. It's bilge, they don't have such a right. But that's what they'll tell you. And when you say, who the hell said that? They say, Lord Denning said that. Well, I've got a tame barrister. And I mentioned this to him one day, and he went away and he looked up the case, and he wrote me up a nice spiel on it in full legal form. He's very tame, he don't charge me a penny, I just buy him the occasional dinner. And Lord Denning said that a chief officer of police has the right to decide how he allocates his limited resources of money. However, if he took a policy decision not to investigate thefts of less than £100 in value, the courts would overturn it. Which is not the same as saying you can do what you like, is it? Lord Salmon, he said, where the police use their prerogative not to prosecute young teenage boys for sleeping with young women just under the age of 16, that is a correct use of their prerogative, and in any case the courts would be unlikely to penalise the boys because of the closeness of their ages. We're talking about voluntarily sleeping with them, not raping them. But were the police to decide as a policy decision not to investigate housebreakers, every householder in the country would be able to apply to the courts for an order of mandamus to force them to deal with housebreakers, and the courts would grant it. And the third judge, whose name escapes me, but I love him, he said, the proposition put forward so eloquently by the Metropolitan Police's barrister that they have a right to decide which crimes they investigate and which ones they don't is both bald and startling. And if the courts were to agree with that, it would place the police above the law, and that we will never do. So we wrote that up and we printed it out. And we sent it off to every chief constable in the country. And we said, don't ever quote Blackstone again. Mm-hmm. And so far they haven't. We had two judges, Lord Newburger, Master of the Rolls, told all our judges that they have in fact got to use English common law in the courts, rather than European law. He was promptly overruled by Lord Judge and Lord Chief Justice. who said that courts must give precedence to European law. So I wrote to Lord Newburger and I told him that 99.9% of the thinking people in this country agreed with him, he's top of the class, keep it up, we love you. What I said to him. I put that letter on the internet and said, can everybody please write to Lord Newburger in a similar vein? And they did, hundreds of them. And he acknowledged every letter. And I wrote to Lord Judge. And I said, by taking the decision that you have, you actually contravene the Act of Supremacy of 1559, which is a personal treason against Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth II. And you have contravened the Bill of Rights of 1689, which is a treason contrary to the English Constitution. We will at some stage be coming to talk to you about your treason. And I put that on the internet, and loads of people wrote to him, but nobody got acknowledgement. Then I sent every judge in the country one of these. It's a little booklet I've written. I've condensed 800 years of legal history into 32 very readable pages. I'm told it should be current reading in every school. And I sent one to every judge, including Lord Judge. And I got quite a nice letter back from Lord Judge saying he'd read the book with a great deal of interest. And the next thing we heard was Lord Judge was going around telling the judges they have to use English common law in the courts rather than European law. And now he's retired and he's on the lecture circuit. He's going around telling all the people that he lectures that we've got to use English common law in the courts rather than European law. We've changed the mind of the Lord Chief Justice of England. Now, knowledge is a weapon. There's 32 pages of weapon here. I'm flogging these, they're £3 a throw. I don't want to take any home. But knowledge is a weapon, and it has to be applied properly. And it has to be applied with a bit of sense. And you have to look at things a bit pragmatically. Let's assume that Prince Charles knew that Jimmy Savile was an out-and-out paedophile. Let's assume that the Queen is an absolute out-and-out bitch. 80% of the people in this country won't agree with you, so if you attack the Queen, they attack you, and they bury you. So we have to. Whether the Queen is good or bad, whether Charles is good or bad, whether Andrew is a paedophile or not, we have to follow the royal family. We have to get them because they are the people that we need to lead this country against the House of Commons. Shake your head as much as you like, darling, you're wrong. We have to get them to lead this country against the House of Commons. Our problem is not the House of Lords, it is not Buckingham Palace, it is the House of Commons. Tony Blair is an evil man. Positively evil. You look at him, he looks evil. I actually saw a photograph of him once, he had two round rings on his head like that.
Usually you give
him
out.
His wife ain't any better, is she? David Cameron. I'm proud of my Ashkenazi roots. The Ashkenazis are the people running the banks that are charging us extortionate amounts of money. They are the people running all the big corporations. They are the people that are bankrupting people left, right and centre and leaving them homeless. But David Cameron is one of them, and he's proud to be. I wrote to him, and I said to him, David, your Bullingdon boy days are over. No longer are you in a position where you can wreck a restaurant just for the hell of it, and not go to prison because you pay the owner of the restaurant for a full restoration. And he's lots of earnings. Because you haven't got enough money to pay for the damage you've done to my country. And I intend to hang you for it. I want them to be frightened. I want them to be scared. When I started reporting treason, the first time I reported treason at a police station, they laughed. Then they stopped laughing. Then every police force in this country started talking to every other police force in this country about how do we avoid dealing with treason. I know that. I've got friends who are still serving. It's on the computer. They tell me. Now I've got 17 police forces out of 44 in this country have all accepted allegations of treason. Hiccup is the Metropolitan Police Commissioner. And I said to him, when I wrote to him, there were only 13 police forces. I said, if you think for 1 minute these 13 chief constables, when push comes to shove, and it is coming to shove, are going to turn around and tell the judge in the court, no, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. It wasn't really, we shouldn't have recorded an allegation of treason. Forget it. The minute they say that, they're all guilty of misprison of treason. They go to prison for life. They lose their job, their family, their home, everything. They go to prison for life. They're not going to do that for you. And apart from anything else, every last one of them wants your job. They're going to laugh and clap when you go to prison. Because they all want your job. Right, are there any questions?
So wrap it up.
Okay.
Okay.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.